For the week of February 2nd, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 223, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And somewhere in Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wow, so you made it all the way to Pennsylvania already.
Already, yes. I'm sort of a vagabond these next few months. Been up upstate New York, back to the city. Now I'm heading to my brother's in Pennsylvania. I've left my old apartment. My new one won't be ready yet for a couple months. So I'm back and forth. I'm just on the road. I'm a rambler. I'm a rambling man.
Right. Well, you know, entertainment journalists often spend a lot of their time traveling to cover stories. So you're kind of doing the same thing.
Well, while I was on the road, I missed something. Just as we finished recording our podcast last week, Pete Seeger died.
That's right. Yes, unfortunately. Of course, he is the, I guess, a world-renowned folk singer.
Well, unfortunately, he was 94 years old. It would, you know, if he was 130, we'd be like, we'd start to get worried. Why isn't he dying? So, but it was, you know, he's a legend. It's one of my favorite Bruce Springsteen albums is a tribute album to him called the Seeger Sessions. And, you know, he's at times been pilloried and hated and, you know, blacklisted in earlier groups, you know, off of the charts, off the airwaves. No one would play him. Now he's a lovable national icon.
Well, I guess what he was called in 1955 in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, and he refused to say anything. So he was held in contempt of Congress.
That's right. He was a communist. He was a member of the Communist Party. He had quit it before they asked him to come before the committee. And he later said he should have quit earlier because he didn't realize what an evil person Stalin was. But, you know, that whatever your political beliefs are, unless you're acting as a traitor and acting to undermine the country, it shouldn't matter, of course. And it was a dark, dark time. But he went from being, you know, blacklisted to being grudgingly accepted to still being seen as a lefty to now, once you get into old age, you're a beloved icon.
Well, and I suppose he wrote a lot of songs that other people sang. As you mentioned, Bruce Springsteen covered a whole, you know, he did a whole album.
Actually, most of his album was songs Seeger popularized. He was as much known for that as anything else, being a popularizer of folk music and singing and championing other writers. He certainly wrote some himself, but a lot of the Seeger Sessions album was, in fact, songs he popularized rather than wrote himself, though he certainly did that as well.
Well, and he wrote the Hammer song, popularized by Peter, Paul, and Mary during the 1960s.
That's right.
Yes. Do you want to sing us a few bars?
I would love to, but I won't.
Well, we have some other unfortunate news. Tom Scherrick died last week as well at the age of 68. He is the former head of the Motion Picture Academy, the group that hands out the Academy Awards. He headed it from 2009 to 2012.
And he was the head of Fox for two decades, practically.
Yes, he was there when I was an intern and worked there in the publicity department in New York. And to me, he will always be remembered as the guy who turned down Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. He put it into turnaround and New Line Cinema picked it up.
Not a good idea.
But he was also the guy that picked up Home Alone. So,
well, there you go. Well, and he what a Hollywood ending in a way. I mean, the man was fighting cancer, prostate cancer, the last years of his life. He was in chemotherapy. He was hired by L.A. to be the film czar and try and stop the bleeding of production going to other cities, states, and countries. But there he is literally on his deathbed, and they are installing a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in honor of him, literally hours before he died. The ceremony was already scheduled for February 14th, and they were putting the star in place just as he passed away. It doesn't get more Hollywood than that.
That is true. I'm waiting for the movie.
And of course, if you were going to see a movie about the life of animation legend Arthur Rankin Jr., it would probably be in stop motion animation.
That's true. He is the legend with Rankin and Bass, Jules Bass, who is, I guess, 78, still alive, as Michael informed me right before we began recording.
That's right. You had him dead.
I had him. Well, I didn't have him dead.
He's not Canadian and he's not dead.
He's 78. But
Arthur Rankin was 89.
Right. And unfortunately passed away. He is one of the animators and one of the producers of Frosty the Snowman and,
well, more importantly, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and those stop motion animation things that they did. They're, you know, known still, shown every year on television, a great looking and feeling type thing. I think the Lego movie, which is coming out and has great early reviews from Hollywood Reporter and Variety, it's done as a Lego movie. I think kids at home who watch that Lego movie and have made Lego movies themselves are all in the shadow of Rankin Bass and their stop motion productions that they made for television. They were just delightful little things. You don't need 3D and massive special effects. You can sit in your home and move a little toy here, take a picture, and suddenly you got yourself a clever little movie, as long as you've got imagination and heart.
Well, and George Pal as well was an animator that Rankin and Bass took after. So, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. They weren't the first. And yes. Ray Harryhausen, of course. But Jules Bass, if you're alive and you're listening, call me because I have a great project that you should be doing. Actually, the rights to their stuff is owned by Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live. So I really should be asking him to call me, but you never know.
Okay.
And then, of course, the saddest news of all, not saddest of all, but tragic, really.
That's true. Philip Seymour Hoffman, of course, we have to mention that he passed away at the age of 46. He died of what looks to be a drug overdose.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt. They're now up to 70 bags of heroin were found in his home, 20 needles, a bunch of prescription drugs. This is in his apartment down in Greenwich Village where he had his office. He had a wife and two children. He was in films. He was in theater. He was directing theater. He had a new series for Showtime. You know, he had everything in the world, but he obviously also had addiction issues. Did not seem to be a troubled man, as far as I know. I never heard rumors about him being dark and unhappy, but obviously he struggled with addiction. It's just a tragic, stupid way to die. It makes me feel very Nancy Reagan.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, it's funny. The number of people that came up to me and talked about this were people that I wasn't really expecting to even follow such news.
It's news all over. You know, it's big news.
Yeah, I mean, and
he's an Oscar winner. He's been nominated for 4 Oscars, nominated for 3 Tonys. Been a lot of good movies. You know, he's not a superstar, but he's a well-known. I mean, he's in The Hunger Games. You know, they've got one big scene he hadn't filmed yet. You know, he's in that movie. That's, you know, not a great movie, but it's certainly a very popular one.
I guess what was shocking for me was that I had just run into him at Sundance a week earlier.
Well, he's 46. You don't expect him to die.
Yeah. You know, my Philip Seymour Hoffman anecdote, I suppose, is back in 2001 at Sundance. He was lesser known then. And I guess that was during the first big dot-com bubble and the big swag bubble up at Park City every year. All of these companies would come. They'd rent out houses and they'd throw these big parties every night. And so after the films ended, myself and a few other journalists, I was actually dragged most of the time up to this one particular house in Deer Valley called the Chrysler Lounge. And it was Chrysler had, you know, rented this house and was throwing parties every night. One night, Alanis
Did they give him a car?
No. But it was like definitely one of the nicer houses and lounges to be in the evenings. So they threw some of the better receptions, if you will. And they had all of these different sponsors in the house, including, I think it was not Microsoft necessarily. I think it was Sony PlayStation. But I was so bored at these parties because, I wasn't really drinking because I'd have to wake up the next day and go see movies. So all of a sudden, I start playing this Star Wars game on whatever Nintendo PlayStation thing was there. And I'm playing it on one screen. And all of a sudden, somebody is playing against me. And I couldn't figure out who it was, but it was somebody in the house. And I realized it's this guy standing next to me. I wasn't even really paying attention to who it was, but it was Philip Seymour Hoffman wearing a baseball cap. And every night, we played several nights in a row, probably 5-6 nights in a row. We were there at this Chrysler Lounge playing this Star Wars game. We got quite good at it, actually. And every time I ran into him, including last week, I would, joke around about it. But, it was my little anecdote about Philip Seymour Hoffman long before he was really as well known as he became.
So you're about equal?
I would say, a few times he won, a few times I won.
All right. Well, Hollywood, stop dying because we've wasted 10 minutes and all we've talked about is death. Can we move on?
It was very difficult to stay alive in Hollywood this week.
Yeah.
But on today's show, we're going to talk about other things. We're going to tell you about all the latest Guild Awards and how they may or may not have moved the needle on this year's Oscar race. And since we're talking about the Oscars, well, we're going to have to talk about, we have to talk about this subject on Inside Baseball. We're going to tell you all about the controversy over the Academy rescinding a nomination for Best Song. Usually they're announcing nominations. This time they said, we're going to announce it one week and take it back the next.
The Academy giveth. The Academy taketh away.
That's true. Now, the big news in television is all about the Super Bowl. The big winner of the big game wasn't the Seattle Seahawks.
Yes, it was.
Well, it kind of was. But Fox, which attracted a record audience to view the championship matchup. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to wandering entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I am so excited for the weekend box office because this is a weekend where you realize why we talk about worldwide box office. First of all, a little bit later, we've got a roundup of worldwide box office for 2013, country by country, with breakdowns about who's doing better, who's doing worse, and why. We'll try to go through that quickly, but that's very interesting. But this weekend, if you were just looking at North America, sort of a boring weekend. Ride Along was repeating for the third weekend in a row. It's a successful comedy. It's just about to pass $100 million. It's a very good hit. It only cost $25 million to make. It's at $92 million and counting. It made $12 million this weekend. But most of the news was about movies that flopped or didn't do great. That Awkward Moment opened up. It's this guy sort of buddy comedy, but they sort of pitched it to women. It's a little confusing, but it stars Zac Efron and Miles Teller from The Spectacular Now.
And
but
Whiplash. Miles Teller was in Whiplash, the Sundance winner this year.
Oh, that's right. And the Sundance winner, Whiplash. Is he the actual drummer?
He is the actual drummer.
Well, there you go. That's very cool. But it only cost $8 million to make. And then there's Labor Day, which is a Jason Reitman film. This guy is a perennial Oscar nominee. He's made a lot of commercially successful films like Up in the Air and Juno and others. And this movie was just dumped. And it made no attention. It just flopped big time. That's sort of the news of the North American box office. Flops, movies that underperformed. Third weekend big winner, but it's sort of modest box office all around because it's North America and everyone's at the Super Bowl. So if you look at the worldwide box office, there's a lot of exciting news because it's the Chinese Lunar New Year. It's a big holiday weekend for movies. And you can certainly see that at the box office where the big news is all around the world, but not in North America. The number one movie in the world is The Monkey King, which opened to $46 million. I think it opened like mid last week or something, or just made a few bucks the week before, because it's now in wide release. It's made $54 million so far. This is another adaptation of Journey to the West, the classic Chinese tale. It's just a story embedded in their consciousness. One of the biggest movies last year in China was also about Journey to the West. It was a different movie. This is really geared towards families and kids. I don't know how well it'll translate to North America, but it's a monster at the box office. Number two around the world also opened up in China. This is Dad, Where Are We Going? It opened not just in China. You know, this did just open in China.
Yes.
The Monkey King opened in multiple territories. Dad, Where Are We Going? Or Where Are We Going, Dad? Depending on who's doing the translation. That opened just in China. It made $34 million. Now, this is based on a Chinese TV reality series, which itself is based on a South Korean reality series. And I can't believe that nobody in America has snapped this up yet. This is a show where celebrity fathers go to spend the weekend with one of their children. They take one of their little kids and they go away with other celebrity dads, and they are responsible for taking care of their child, and they go do activities with the other dads and their kids. So you've got like a big football star with a little baby boy or little girl, and he's got to change their diapers. He's got to make sure they go to bed. He's got to make sure they get fed. He has to be a dad. You know, these people who are perhaps busy with careers and haven't paid attention to their kids, suddenly they are solely responsible. But they also want to spend time with their kids. They're so busy, they miss being, you know, dad and spending time with them. So it's heart-tugging, it's funny, and you get like a rock star and a politician and an athlete all together mixed up for the weekend. So it's just a wildly, wildly popular TV show in China. And now they spun it off into a feature film. It's not fictional. It's a documentary. But boy, this just is ripe for exploitation in North America.
Oh, God, please no.
Oh, of course. You're going to have Peyton Manning, you know, licking his wounds and taking his kid to Disney. What do you do when you lost the Super Bowl? You still go to Disney World. And of course, in China, this first day, it set an all-time record. In one day, they grossed $41 million in China, which, frankly, is not that much money. We've had movies alone gross $100 million in North America. But, you know, it's China. They're still going. It's one day. $41 million. It's the biggest day of box office in history in China. And you can see, again, they've got a long way to go. So that's big news, but it doesn't stop there. Number three around the world is Frozen. Another $33 million. It's at $864 million. It's clearly going to blow past $900 million. And now I'm not quite sure what's left, but my God, it's still making $33 million last week. It's clearly got a shot at $1
billion. $1 billion. You know, and what's left? I'll tell you what's left is China. The movie opens on Wednesday in China.
Ooh,
and it's
wow.
Just going to...
So they avoided those, but those are big blockbusters in its way. So you better hope that China lets it play more than a week.
Well, this is the Lunar New Year holiday, which ends February 15th. So it's one of the highest movie-going
So it's like our Christmas.
That's correct. Yes.
Where every day is just a big day at the box office.
Correct.
All right. Well, hopefully they'll get to play out in China, and that could help put it over the top. At number four around the world is The Wolf of Wall Street, another $30 million. It's at $226 million. It's the third highest grossing Scorsese film, as we told you it would become. It needs another $75 million to become number one all time for Martin Scorsese. At number five around the world is V. This is a Russian film. It is based on a Nikolai Gogol short story, but it's no literary effort. This is a horror film about a demon named Vi, and it grossed $17 million in Russia. At number six is Miss Granny. That's a film we talked about before, about an old woman going back into her younger body. It grossed another $15 million. At number seven is Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit. It made $14 million. It passed the $100 million mark and needs every penny of it overseas as it struggles to get to profitability and convince the studios to make another edition. Maybe next time they'll actually promote Chris Pine as the star.
Yeah, why weren't they promoting Chris Pine as the star? And I guess they were initially, but then they pulled back.
I mean, all the posters were just, they downplayed him. They had Kevin Costner and the women, and it was just like you barely knew he was in it. You know, the poster didn't even say Chris Pine. You know, I really think they missed the boat there. You know, sometimes you make a movie to help create a star, not just to exploit one, but you say, I believe in this guy's going to be a star in the future. And you use the movie to promote him. And then the next movie, you reap the benefits. But there you go. At number eight around the world is The Man from Macau. This is the fourth in, I think, the Gods of Gamblers series. It's a Hong Kong film. It stars the great Chow Yun-fat. It's sort of a comedy crime drama. And it is the fourth in the series.
Yes, it is.
And it made, what did it make? About $12 million, I think, in Hong Kong. Well, it's in six territories. So Hong Kong, perhaps China and some other places. I don't know.
$12.5 million.
Yes. Well, yeah, I rounded it down. We're not accountants. Okay. And number nine is Ride Along, another $12 million, as we mentioned. Again, it's at $94 million worldwide. It has opened overseas, but only very modestly. It's made just like $1.1 million this weekend in the rest of the world. And number 10 is 12 Years a Slave, another $11 million. That's at $96 million. It's about to pass the $100 million mark. That's a huge success story for Steve McQueen and his film 12 Years a Slave. And number 11, a big bomb, I, Frankenstein. Whatever this is supposed to be, it didn't work. It made $11 million. It's at $40 million worldwide.
But do you think this movie was ever supposed to work? I mean, I know nobody sets out to make a bad movie.
Nobody makes a movie to make a bad movie.
But I mean, come on. I mean, you just look at the trailer and there's no way this movie was ever.
It was based on a well thought of graphic novel, I believe, or comic book series. I'm not sure which now, okay. But it was one or the other. So, you know, it had a good source material, at least source material people saw, they read it, they liked it, but it cost $65 million to make, and it just didn't work. It didn't succeed as an action film. It didn't succeed as a horror film. Sometimes weird things like Frankenstein as a futuristic warrior to defend the Earth, you can convince yourself of it in the context of a graphic novel, but it doesn't work as a movie, or it works as a movie, but it doesn't work as a TV show. You know, things don't always translate, and this clearly is one of the cases. Now, did you see that awkward moment? This is the Zac Efron, Miles Teller film, which was sort of a guy movie, but somehow sort of pitched to women.
I did not see that movie.
No, okay. It made $10 million. It seemed oddly promoted and marketed. It didn't want to be a raunchy dude comedy, but it didn't want to be a chick flick either. And it sort of fell in between the cracks. But it opened on Super Bowl weekend as sort of counter programming, though I guess maybe they thought some gay guys would go as well because it starred Zac Efron. You know, I'm not sure, quite sure who they're on. And clearly they were geared towards women, but it's a guy film. It's sort of a weird, but it didn't quite work. But it only cost $8 million to make. So you say, oh, it didn't open well. Well, it only cost $8 million. I'm sure they spent money to promote it. But hey, it made more than its budget on opening weekend. That's always a good sign. At number 13 is the Scorsese wannabe film American Hustle, directed by David O. Russell. Another $10 million. That's at $181 million. Let's not take that for granted. Is that his highest grossing film of all time? I'm just asking. I don't actually even know. But I think it must be, right? I mean, what else The Fighter, did that make $200 million?
I think it may have.
This guy is not making big commercial movies, and yet they are clicking at the box office. They're making them for the right price. I don't know what American Hustle costs, but Silver Linings Playbook, which is his biggest hit to date, cost $21 million to make, and it grossed $227 million. The Fighter cost $11 million and made $130 million. You know, he just wrote on that. But so that, I mean, that's Three Kings, made $100 million worldwide. Flirting with Disaster and Spanking the Monkey were his early efforts. But once he broke out, he's really kept his budgets reasonable and making really good movies. And here's American Hustle. It looks set to pass Silver Linings Playbook as his biggest hit of all time. And, you know, more credit to him. Whatever you think of the film, you know, he's getting it done.
Well, yeah, I don't know whether he'll get it done when it comes to the Academy Awards, which we'll talk about in a moment. But
that's true. But he's certainly got, you know, tons of nominations yet again, 2 years in a row or two movies in a row.
Yes,
that's certainly
can't
very
fault
admirable.
That. Cannot fault that.
Yeah. And number 14 is The Nut Job, the Canadian-South Korean co-production. It made $9 million. It's at $50 million and counting worldwide. At number 15 is The Lone Survivor, the Mark Wahlberg war film, which everybody keeps telling me, dude, this movie's really good. I really have to go check it out. It made $8 million and it's at $110 million and counting. A RoboCop, did we cover that? That opened up overseas. RoboCop is down at number 17. It made $5 million in three territories. I don't know where. Even the fanboy geeks that I know are not looking forward to this
where
film.
Do you think, given that it's Lunar New Year, where do you think RoboCop
opened
up? Oh,
it's in China?
Yes, it is.
All right, there you go.
It's in Asia.
Well, that's a very exciting box office as far as I'm concerned. Flops in North America, very quiet, but then when you go overseas, you realize there's a lot of movies making a lot of money all over the world, and movies that we're going to see in North America, or at least see adapted, whether it says film or television, I'm certain Dad, Where Are We Going? Is going to come to America.
Well, but some of these countries aren't doing too poorly in and of themselves and with their own films. We'll get to that in a minute. But since we were talking about the Oscars, and I don't want to take anything away from David O. Russell. I was only kind of trying to segue us into talking about some of these awards that occurred over the past week.
And he lost.
And he lost. So, yeah, I guess that was a bad segue because the WGA Awards, David O. Russell was, nominated with Eric Warren Singer, and they did not write together. That's an and. So here's a little trivia, a little tidbit for you. When you look at screenwriting credits and there's an ampersand between the two writers, when there's two writers and there's an ampersand, those are two writing partners. So
that's like Sperling and Mike, ampersand.
Yes. Whereas Eric Warren Singer, the word and then David O. Russell, those are two different screenwriters, both of whom took passes at the script, and the WGA credited both of them for writing the script, but they wrote separately.
That's right. So one wrote a draft, and then somebody else came in and did a rewrite or overwrite, or maybe somebody came up with the idea, but the final credit ended up being written by Eric Warren Singer and A&D, David O. Russell. In contrast, you also have Blue Jasmine, written alone by Woody Allen, Dallas Buyers Club, which was also written by two people who took different stabs at the story. One was Craig Borton, and the other was Melissa Wallach. Nebraska was written by Bob Nelson, all by himself, and the winner was Spike Jones, who wrote the original screenplay for Her. And I've seen four of those five films, and I think Her is by far the most worthy winner, so I'm glad that they won Best Original Screenplay.
Really? So, you know, I could see maybe over, well, between American Hustle, Blue Jasmine, and Her.
I didn't see American Hustle, as I said.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I'm saying I did not see that. I've seen the other four, and Her is by far my favorite of those four.
Yeah, I loved Her, and I do believe it is worthy. So, yes.
And it could very well be where Oscar would recognize that film.
I think that it
probably
would
a fair
be.
Amount of love, and that's where it will be. If it gets any Oscar, that's the one.
Yes, well, and that's their way of rewarding Spike Jones. He is the screenwriter. He is the director. If they give him the...
It's a great screenplay.
Right, and if they give him the Academy Award for the screenplay, they're awarding him and the film moving on. That's
adapted screenplay, of course, was not won by any of those people. We won't go through the writing teams, but they were August Osage County, Before Midnight, Survivor, The Wolf of Wall Street. By the way, Survivor's a really good film, dude. And the winner was...
And you know, every time you say Survivor, Lone Survivor, Survivor, like you break up. So I think it's very funny. All we've ever heard you say is Survivor.
Survivor. Lone Survivor. And the winner, however, was Captain Phillips, the Tom Hanks and Somali Pirates film.
Did you see that coming? I did not see that coming.
No, but that's, you know, it is August Osage County was not a well thought of film. Before Midnight was a possibility, I think.
Right.
Lone Survivor and The Wolf of Wall Street, I think those are all problematic. I mean, Lone Survivor is a good film, dude, but Wolf of Wall Street, a lot of people have issues with it. They admire it overall, but maybe, you know, the people being upset that it's not moralistic enough, which is idiotic, but, you know, so they all have people who are unhappy with it to a degree. So Captain Phillips is a very good adaptation of either a novel, or, yes, it's a book, a nonfiction book by Richard Phillips with Stephen Talty. And, you know, it was fact-based, but involving, got a lot of humanity and heart into what is a very sort of actioning thing about
guys being taken over by pirates. And, you know, they made it real. They humanized the Somalis without making them heroes. You know, I thought it was a very good job. Of those five, I would certainly pick that one myself.
Well, and in television, Breaking Bad won for drama. Veep, or VP, however you want to pronounce that.
It's Veep.
Veep.
It's pronounced Veep.
One for comedy series, and House of Cards won for new television series.
And that's, of course, just started its second season and getting reviews that basically say, well, if you like the first season, you'll like this one. And they've already been renewed for their third season by Netflix.
But will they spend $50 million?
Well, they won't need to. They got the sets, they got the people, whatever. You know, once you're in the zone, once you've made that initial investment, it doesn't cost as much.
Okay, well, that's writing. Let's move on to cinematography, because here's where I think this is a given. Yeah, this is a given.
All the tech awards are going to Gravity.
Yes.
Gravity is going to win every technical award in sight. If it doesn't, you know, it's clearly not going to win Best Picture. But even if it wins all the tech awards, you can't say, well, it's moving towards Best Picture, because it's just, it's the one that's going to take all of these. Sound mixing, editing, cinematography, special effects, Gravity, Gravity, Gravity.
But I would argue, and I think the industry would argue, that cinematography is a craft. Yes, it's technical, but it's not as technical as special effects or sound mixing.
I don't know what you mean by technical. Like, make it sound like a bad thing.
No, no, no. I'm just saying it's more of an artistic craft.
They're all artistic. Special effects are artistic.
Okay.
Everything's artistic. The whole damn thing is artistic. Sound mixing is artistic.
Okay, fine.
Believe me, I just saw Hannah Arendt, and that had horrifically bad sound mix. Oh, my God. The dubbing was terrible. Oh, God.
You saw what to who? What?
Hannah Arendt, the film about the philosopher who wrote The Banality of Evil, that story for The New Yorker and book about the trial of Adolf Eichmann, which a lot of people liked. The female lead is supposed to be very good. So get ready for my end of the year list. I watched the film. I did not care for it. And the sound mix was horrible.
You know, for a minute there, I was wondering if you were talking English.
Hannah Arendt. Well, she speaks German. But there you go. So Gravity won the Cinematographer's Award, didn't it?
Yes. And Emmanuel Lubezki, who has already won this award, the ASC Award, twice before, for The Tree of Life and for Children of Men. So he's
won. And he really deserved it for Tree of Life.
Yes. And he won it again this year. He has not won an Academy Award, has been nominated, and everybody's pointing at him for this particular award.
But it's still controversial, because a lot of the film is done digitally. And so they talk about, well, what exactly is he doing as a cinematographer? But he's overseeing the digital stuff and how it looks and the lighting of it, meaning lighting as in how you simulate lighting in the design. So it's a very tricky issue, it looks good. You can see that's the ultimate turnout. And so you say, well, he deserves it. But it's not straightforward, because you're in a blue screen and you're dealing with special effects, and there's very little putting up a light to make a room look good. It ain't like that anymore.
No, actually, over the past 2 to 3 years, the ASC Awards and cinematography in general, all the cinematography awards, have really become a commentary on film, traditional 35mm film, which is becoming harder and harder to get, let alone shoot on, and digital capture. So, you know, 2K, 4K, 6K, and 8K capture. And let's face it, Lubezki shot this one digitally. I believe he also shot Tree of Life digitally. And so they're really kind of making a statement here by saying, look, digital is the future. Now, I would agree with you. Traditional cinematography, where you have a tree and a person and a light and you can shoot it without green screen and without digital effects, is different than digital cinematography. But I would argue that digital cinematography, where you don't have everything that you're shooting in place at the same time, mm-hmm, might be more difficult.
It's a different task.
I agree.
Yeah, but it is under the umbrella of cinematography for the moment. It may be something that they have to change in the future as the way we make film changes.
Yes.
There you go. And in Australia, of course, they had the Australian Oscars. I wonder what film won that one.
Now, this is what I had put this in, because I thought it was very funny that, you know, here, what film hasn't been mentioned during this awards season? It was kind
of Thief.
Well, that yes, but it was
I told you it wouldn't be
a Cannes opening night film. It was a big hurrah in the middle of the year. It was pushed back from 2012 Christmas release, and everybody thought, oh, it might be a player at the end of the year. Well, no, The Great Gatsby, starring Leonardo DiCaprio. Nobody's talking about this movie come awards season. I think maybe for costumes it was awarded. But in Australia, it won some of the top honors.
Well, it was Baz Luhrmann. He's their biggest director, certainly their most commercially successful. And the movie made $350 million worldwide. So it cost a lot to make, that's true. But nonetheless, you know, it's a $200 million budget. It probably lost money, but not a lot of money. And it's a big brouhaha. It's a big kahuna when it comes to Australia. So I don't think it was positioned for end of the year stuff. And if it's an opening night film at Cannes, you know, it's probably not a very good film. That's traditionally what happens there.
Well, Moulin Rouge opened Cannes.
It got the attention. That's the rare exception that proves the rule.
Okay.
So it's a film that got all the publicity it wanted from that slot, and it made probably the most money it could. I mean, you know, it's just not a very good movie.
Well, and Elizabeth Moss, I guess, won for best miniseries.
New Zealand film. Yeah, Jane Campion won for best miniseries, and it stars Elizabeth Moss, a very good actress, but I did not like Top of the Lake. I thought it was a lot of nothing.
It's 7 hours of nothing, right? I mean,
oh my God, Holly Hunter, chew, chew, chew. There's no scenery left.
Call the insurance company.
Exactly. Well, that's Australia. Yeah.
Well, The Great Gatsby, it earned $27.4 million in Australia, and I'm assuming that those are Australian dollars. It was ranked as the sixth highest Oz film of all time, the sixth highest Australian-made film of all time in Australia.
Mm, wow. That's a monster hit. And, of course, Australia, as overall, though, was at an eight-year low. It dropped about 5%.
Well, wait a second. You just said that you dropped that like a bomb. And I should point out, James Gardner sent in this link to us. From If Magazine, but it's if.com.au is the website. And it was really talking about it's hitting an eight-year low for Australian-produced films, local films.
Well, absolutely. There's a story in The Hollywood Reporter, which is similar. It goes country by country, which we're getting to, that talks about every major territory and how they did, why they were up, why they were down compared to last year. And Australia is one of them. And Australia, they grossed $965 million at the box office in 2013, almost $1 billion.
Wait, this is Australian 5%. Dollars. Australian dollars. Let's highlight.
No, this is convert. No, this is converted.
Oh,
this is the
okay.
Hollywood Reporter. We're talking U.S. dollars. So it's just below $1 billion. It's down 5%, which is, you know, every year cannot be up, people. This is what drives me nuts. You know, something goes down. They're like, well, you know, you can't keep grossing more. Eventually, you'll be grossing $80 gazillion at the box office. It's not reasonable. But anyway, all the hits were Hollywood. There were no big Australian hits unless you count The Great Gatsby, which certainly is a big Hollywood film, but it's overseen by an Australian director. So they certainly get some credit for that.
Right.
And they had 23 million people in Australia, and they grossed almost $1 billion.
Wait a second.
So
there's
now,
only
you think about that. You think about how movie crazy they are. We don't have per capita and all that, but 23 million people. The U.S. is 330 million people, right? And we have $10 billion. They almost had $1 billion. So 10 times that is 230 million. They go see more movies in Australia than we do. Even though this year was down per capita, they are punching above their weight. So they are just as movie crazy as we are in the United States.
Well, I think James wanted us to comment on the fact that I guess the amount that Australian made movies are making in Australia is going down. Obviously, the biggest year. What year do you think that was, Michael? The biggest year of all time for Australian made movies.
The biggest year of all time?
Yes. Highest grossing, that meaning the highest grossing.
I'm thinking like, I don't know, Peter Weir, Glass Gallipoli, and all those movies, the Year of Lip, but those aren't really big commercial Australia. Oh, the Yahoo Einstein or whatever that guy.
No, that Priscilla.
Priscilla,
Queen of the Desert, actually. That was in the past 20 years. It was in 1994, so, you know, 20 years ago. Uh-huh. And I guess they also had Muriel's Wedding and Lightning Jack. That's when the take was up 9.8%. That was the best result for Australian-made films.
That was the best in the last 20 years, you said, not all time.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's when Australian films accounted for 9.8% of the Australian box office. That's what I meant to say.
All right. The best of all time, what was the movie that did it?
Crocodile Dundee.
Oh, see, I always thought that was a bigger hit overseas.
1986.
I never realized that it was I thought maybe Australians would be like, oh, come on. But that's awesome. All right, Crocodile Dundee, a massive hit. What year was that, 86?
1986.
All right, and the low point?
23.5% is when is what they you know, had accounted for in 1986. The low point was in, I want to say, 2004, when Australian films only accounted for 1.3% of the Australian box office. And when I went over all of these numbers, as James requested we do, I had to say what I saw here was some really erratic numbers. So though more
because they can't produce 30, 40, 50 films a year.
Right.
And so you're it's like a single studio rather than a huge slate. So you're always going to have up and down years for any one studio, but other studios pick up the slack. Maybe this year Paramount has the big hit. Next year it's Fox. When you're a country that with 23 million people, you've only got so many at bats. So you just, there's no way you're going to have success year after year after year. You don't have enough times at the plate. So it's nothing reflective of their creativity or their talent. It's just some years are going to be up. Some year you're going to have Muriel's Wedding to come out of the blue. Another year you're going to make a big film and it's going to connect like Australia, which I imagine did pretty good in that country and, you know, things like that.
Well, yeah. And they track 2,057 screens and in Australia. And I think, yeah, since 2010, you've had some declining share of the Australian box office for Australian films. But I think that just as easily could be corrected. When you look at a 10-year span, you'll see it go down. You'll see it go up. You'll see it go back down again and come back to its norm. You know, I wouldn't look too deeply into this.
I mean, 23 million people is a pretty small population. So you just don't have the economic base to make a lot of big movies. And so it's really hard to compete with Hollywood. But hopefully their local film will stay lean and savvy and they'll keep producing great directors. I don't consider Baz Luhrmann a great director, but like Peter Weir and Baz Luhrmann, commercially successful directors that can go out to the world and keep, you know, making their cinema and translating to Hollywood and all that.
Well, 26 Australian films in 2013, $38 million Australian dollars.
All right. Crikey. Well, so we have a worldwide breakdown. And to sum it up, Europe is down because of the recession. North America is by far and away the biggest territory in the world with a record-breaking $10.9 billion. But when you compare the population, like North America and Australia, you can see people in Australia love movies. They go to a lot of them. And so we have a link to this story in the Hollywood Reporter, and it covers the movies territory by territory or country by country. We don't do every country in the world. We don't have a breakdown for Senegal, for example. Not that I wouldn't be interested, but they show who's up, who's down, and perhaps why. China, of course, is really big news. $3.6 billion in 2013. And we know they just set a record, a single day record in the new year. So that's exciting. They were up 28% over 2012. They had two homegrown hits in the top three, including a film based on Journey to the West. They have 1.3 billion people, however, so you can see they got a lot of room to grow.
Well, and I would point out that last year, they had about 13,000 screens at the end of the year. At the end of this year, they had over 18,000 screens.
Wow.
So yeah, they increased their screen count by 5,000, you know, between 3 and 5,000, and they're like—
right, by 35%, 36%.
Yeah, so there you go.
And how many in North America?
There are about 41,000 movie screens in North
America. Wow. So if you figure what they should have, if they had everything we had, even though you got about 500, 600 million people living day-to-day subsistence level, but nonetheless, they also have 400 million people or so in middle class. If they had what we had, that would translate to like 120,000 screens?
You know, the way you're talking, they had what we had with the subsistence, it almost sounds—
am I making no sense?
I'm
amped up on coffee, baby.
I can tell, and I thought it was maybe the Skype call here that was—
it's just me?
And it's just you. I thought the audio quality might be suffering, but in fact, uh-oh, it's actually, no, it's Michael. Me.
Well, at least I'm not doing heroin.
Oh, my God. Too soon.
Oh, well, I'm not making fun of him. I'm just like, hey, you know, it's just all natural. So tell me about the United Kingdom.
What do you want to know about the United Kingdom? It has sterling as its currency.
Come on. Keep going.
They made $1.94 billion and were down 1%, dominated, of course, by Hollywood titles. They have 65 million people, and so they're just as movie crazy as we are.
That's right, because if you look at almost $2 billion, they have 65 million people. You figure that's like five, you know, we're five times bigger than they are in population size, almost exactly. So that would be $10 billion at the box office. So just like Australia, they're going to movies. There's not a lot of room to grow in the United Kingdom and Australia. They're going to movies as much as we are, and that's pretty impressive. Japan made $1.8 billion. It was down. It had some big local hits. The biggest one was Hayao Miyazaki's The Wind Rises, which I hope wins the Oscar for Best Animated Film. Seven of the top 10 films in Japan were animated. Isn't that fascinating? Boy, that country loves their animated films.
No wonder, like, all of their clothing has Hello Kitty on it.
Exactly.
I'm kidding. Please, people in Japan. I was just joking. As a matter of fact, I'm going to move right along on to France. That earned $1.6 billion. They're down 5%, but let's review. They have 65 million people. So a country with 65 million people earning $1.6 billion, not bad.
Not bad. They love their movies, too. Not quite as much as us, not quite as much as the UK, but they're getting there. India made $1.5 billion. They're up 10%, but they, in contrast, are dominated by Bollywood. Hollywood barely registers in India. Our movies barely get to play there. They're not high-grossing. I'm not sure if there's any legal hurdles that we have like we do in China, or whether it's just culturally they don't give a damn about our movies. Maybe you know better, Sperling.
No, it is cultural. So that is more Hollywood films are playing there. They are underscreened. They have an emerging middle class. Ticket prices are much lower in India. So there's a lot of factors going into some of these grosses that are being translated to dollar figures. But in their, you know, native territory or in their home territories, they, you know, that might be an astounding figure. And it is. It's up 10%.
That's right. So that makes sense now, because their top film of the year is Doom 3, D-H-O-O-M 3, and it only made $56 million. But if they're paying 50 rupees or whatever, you know, 50 cents or a dollar to see a movie, well, then that makes sense, doesn't it? That it would be much lower than they might be here in North America. But they've got a billion people, 1.2 billion to be exact. They've got a lot of room to grow. Their movies are coming across to the rest of the world a little bit more, so that's great to see.
You see
them in New York all the time.
And you see them in Los Angeles and Oregon and Washington, D.C. and in Washington State. Mm-hmm. In fact, movies from India are now allowed to play in Pakistan, where over the weekend there was a terrorist attack in a movie theater that killed five people.
That's awful. What a depressing show we have this week. You know, our thoughts go out to them. That's just dreadful, but it could be anywhere. You hate for people to think to be scared to go to a movie. You know, what a horrible thing. In South Korea, of course, they one of our favorite territories. They're a huge creative force in movies right now. $1.5 billion. They're up 6%. Two of the top three films were local hits, including Snowpiercer, the Weinstein film, the film picked up by the Weinsteins, which we may never get to see in the way the director intended. It's very frustrating.
Well, 50 million people, $1.49 billion, not bad. In Germany, it's $1.3 billion. They're down 15%.
They're part of the Europe, and they've had a recession.
Yeah, they're led by the number two film, Fuck You, Goethe.
Goethe. Remember, I've been saying it wrong all this time.
Yes, sorry.
It's a play on Goethe. And so the German is a misspelling, mispronunciation of Goethe. And the translation into English that they're offering now is Suck Me, Shakespeare.
Okay, well, and I can't believe I screwed that up after we had a listener write in about that.
Oh, it's all my fault. I said it wrong so many weeks. Russia, of course, is growing big. They have the Olympics coming. It's, you know, as somebody said, I think it was the New York Times or USA Today. Normally you hear stories about, oh, they're not ready. They're not ready for the Olympics. And you hear that in the months leading up. Oh, this isn't done. That's not done. And then those stories disappear, you know, within the weeks as you get closer and closer because they get done. Not disappearing for Russia this time. Sochi is looking very, very... I think the venues will be fine for the athletes, but I think everything else is going to be kind of a disaster. And with the security threats and the negative press that they're getting, I think this is going to be one of the worst Olympics for that country that, you know, that you've seen in a long, long time, probably since the Israeli athletes were attacked, you know, that
1974.
Horrible.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let's move on from our,
well, no, but seriously, but Russia is a wonderful country, great people, but a horrible leader right now. And they gross, but they're becoming a really big force in commercial cinema.
Well,
$1.3 billion.
$1.3 billion, another traditionally underscreened territory.
Right. So they got a lot of room to grow. They're up 8%. Their local film topped the charts for the first time since the Iron Curtain fell. All they could see for decades were crappy Russian films. And of course, great Russian filmmakers exist, but the movies that got shown in theaters tended to be approved by, you know, government agents, and they tended to be boring, dull by and large. And so once the Iron Curtain fell, they were like, bring on Hollywood, baby. And so every year after year, the biggest film was from overseas. Finally, they have their own hit. It's Stalingrad, that movie we talked about, the 3D IMAX epic about the fall of Stalingrad. And that was the number one film in Russia. So that's good to see, because the stronger movies are creatively in their local territory, the better the movie industry is worldwide.
You know, thank you for reminding me of that film, Stalingrad, because I just got a press screening invite to that film. And I was thinking, God, where have I heard this film before? I've heard about this movie.
You don't even listen to your own show, do you?
You know,
you don't listen to me, to be honest.
We talk about so many films, I completely forget about some of them.
I'm sorry, I find this territory by thing fascinating because you can see how different countries are doing well and why not. Mexico is fascinating. Almost $1 billion, $934 million. They're doing great, up 15% over last year. And they had the number three film was locally grown, sort of, and that's Instructions Not Included, a really big hit here in North America that we talked a lot about. So that's great to see. They got 116 million people, though. Right. So if you triple that, you're at where the U.S. is. That would only be a $3 billion box office at best. They got a lot of room to grow.
They do. And they are another country that has a lot of screens going in.
Oh, really? Are they exploding?
Well, not as much as, say, China and Russia. But, you know, you have Cinepolis and Cinemex there. They're number one and number two theater owners and theater operators.
Really, the only problem with Mexico is that they've got all these illegal immigrants coming down from North America trying to find jobs. And, you know, security. And so you got all those people coming in from Texas and California trying to break into Mexico. And it's sort of bringing the economy down a little bit. But I think they'll survive and do better. You know, they'll assimilate us gringos and let us be part of their country. And hopefully, ultimately, they'll be stronger for it.
You know, as you were making that joke, and I know you were being somewhat satirical there, I was trying to remember the name of the movie in which that actually occurred.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it was one of those like Roland Emmerich doomsday movies where like,
The Day After Tomorrow?
Yes.
With Jake Gyllenhaal?
Yes.
I've seen that three times on TV. I haven't watched it, but I've seen it on TV or somebody else that they're watching. I don't know why it's been in the air lately. It must be on high repeat or something on cable. But, you know, speaking of movies and trying to remember titles, here's one I didn't know what it was in English. So I'm really glad to know. In Italy, $840 million. They're up modestly despite being in Europe, where the recession has been very hard hitting. And their number one film was a local hit. It was Sol a Catanel. And I finally have a good translation, Sun in Buckets. This is like that guy who becomes rich or whatever. It's sort of a, I forget, you remember this film? It's like the comedian and
yes,
suddenly
I
he's
do.
Got lots of money and he's wealthy and throwing money around. But why did Italy become a success? They had a big local hit, of course, but they also lowered ticket prices. So now you're looking at Europe, they're in a recession. And Italy said, well, you know what? People have less money. Maybe we should lower ticket prices a little bit. Maybe people will go to the movies more, see it as a bargain, and everybody will benefit. Even if you make the same amount of box office, right? If you do it with more admissions, you get people in the habit of going to the movies. You're more likely to sell popcorn and soda. It's a win-win.
You know what? I'm going to look into this. I'm thinking maybe this is a post for Celluloid Junkie. I might.
Hot diggity.
Yeah.
Well,
I like this theory.
This is all from the Hollywood Reporter, to give them credit. Brazil, up 6%, $830 million. Mostly Hollywood, but the homegrown movies are pretty solid. They've got 200 million people. And Spain, like a lot of Europe, down 15%. The recession hit them hard. They also have piracy, a lot of piracy. And unlike Italy, a hefty sales tax on movie tickets makes it really pricey to go to the movies. So they only grossed $675 million. So Spain, look at Italy and take a cue from that.
Well, yeah, the tax is really killing them over there, as is piracy. Brazil, 200 million people, and there are about 3,000 screens if they're lucky. So that should tell you how underscreened that
wow.
country is. Yeah.
Well, that's very cool.
Well, okay, so effectively, worldwide box office was up, correct?
Right. I mean, $10 billion in North America, $25 billion yeah, from the rest of the world, and you can see there's a lot of upside coming in the years to come. Worldwide box office should increase for many years.
You know, I don't know how the viewership of the Super Bowl could increase any more than it did this year.
Especially with a blowout game like that.
Yeah, oh my gosh. I made a joke earlier. For those of you who don't know, the Super Bowl is American football's championship game, and the Seattle Seahawks were playing the Denver Broncos. The big news here was that Peyton Manning, the quarterback of the Denver Broncos, 37 years old, came back from neck and back surgery, and he was making a huge comeback, and he took his team all the way to the
Super Bowl and stopped.
Right.
Because you know what? Defense wins championships.
Yes, that is very
take
true.
Take that to the bank. Four out of the five times in history, the best defense of the NFL that season has met the best offense. The best defense has won four out of five times.
Do you know that halfway through the Super Bowl, more than halfway through the Super Bowl this year, third or fourth quarter, I realized I had no idea who the Seattle Seahawks quarterback was. I couldn't tell you his name.
Well, because you don't watch football.
Well, and also, he wasn't a factor.
Oh, okay. Now, do you have Time Warner Cable in L.A.?
I do have Time Warner Cable.
Did you lose it? You lost the Super Bowl for an hour. Oh my God.
Well, first off,
Oh my God. Yeah, I saw that and went, oh, what a disaster. People are like, I want half my year subscription money back. I mean, you cut out during the Super Bowl?
You know,
that's like getting rid of Jesus during Christmas. You can't do that.
Oh my God. Don't you mean getting rid of Santa during Christmas?
I don't know what
Don't you mean getting rid of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer during Christmas?
You lost the Super Bowl.
Okay, so here's what happened. So Time Warner Cable, which in the U.S., there are monopolies, geographic monopolies for different cable providers. It's a big pain in the neck. So Northern California goes to Comcast. Southern California goes to groups like Charter and Time Warner Cable. I'm a Time Warner Cable subscriber. I had it on TiVo. Okay, so I was not watching live. I will admit, although I did not.
I was packing up and moving.
I did not fast forward a single commercial. So, you know, I just didn't have time at 3:30 in the afternoon when it airs here in California to watch the Super Bowl. So I watched it actually when it was over. So I avoided all of the social media and emails. I put my phone away and I turned it on. I must tell you that if the game had not been on there, I would have been livid. However, I was recording the high def channel. So it was the standard def channel that went dark, not the high def channel.
Didn't most people were watching the high def? So it didn't have as big an impact as it would have.
I think that might be the case. However, I will say Time Warner's reasoning or their advice,
defense or apology.
Yeah, their advice for all of this was, well, you could still watch the game on the high def channels. 2 points here, Time Warner Cable. 2 points, okay? One, you wouldn't be doing that if you had a standard def television, okay?
Right.
The second point is, because first of all, the image couldn't get to the screen. It wouldn't show. The second point is, if you didn't have a high def set-top box, you couldn't watch the high def channel anyway. So if you're watching the standard def channel,
nobody with a high def TV is watching the standard channel version.
Oh, you'd be shocked. You'd be shocked. I actually go into
it's not true. My mother and father do. I keep begging them, why are you on these channels? Just change it to here. This is where they all are. Oh, I can't remember those numbers.
Exactly. Because they're all in the 400s or 700s or something silly like that.
Right. But once you're there, you're there.
Yes. Unbelievable.
Oh, but that's true. Well, what a nightmare for them, though. What a PR nightmare.
Yes. Well, you know what a PR nightmare is? Losing 38-9 or whatever it was.
No. 43-8.
40. Yeah.
You're not a football fan. Of course, what a lot of people pay attention to are the ads. I think we won't go through them all, just the pop culture ones. I think the ads, to a surprising degree, were actually not bad this year. They got rid of a lot of the jokey, dumb, stupid ads that were trying to go for a big punchline. They were going for heart and soul and tugging the heartstrings, and that's just easier to do. It's easier to show a soldier coming home.
I couldn't agree more. I want to see that movie with Kavanzane Wallace in it. That was an amazing, it looked like an amazing movie.
Yeah, no, those heart tuggers are just easier to do. Sentimentality is easier to do than some clever, smart little gag that surprises you.
You were supposed to correct me there because that was not a movie trailer. It was commercial for Maserati that nobody knew was a commercial until the last 2 seconds when all of a sudden they went, oh, yeah, by the way, this is a Maserati commercial.
Well, that's the difference between an entertaining ad and an effective ad. So there were certainly some ads that were enjoyable to watch, and you thought, who the hell is going to remember what this was promoting? And that's always a problem. And, you know, it's the Super Bowl. It should be like Cannes, where everybody gears up and can create their best commercial or best movie for that period and knows they want to be ready for that time period. You would think, but the Super Bowl distorts it because it's such a male-centric event, and it's such a particular event. It's not just their best ad, but it has to be their best ad to reach a really broad, big audience. It's not just an ad for people who love ads. It has to be a certain type of ad. So you get a lot of beer, a lot of cars, and it creates just sort of a dumb common denominator. So I think that's why they're often unsatisfying in the last 5-10 years, as the pressure has built to make a great Super Bowl ad, which is not the same thing as just a great ad in general.
Now, I want to point out, because we do have a lot of international listeners, I would say at least half of our listeners are international, and I'm sure they're thinking, why are we talking about this game that we can't watch?
The ads.
Yeah, because really, here's the thing. When I went to Costco, which is a warehouse, you know, you can't buy just a box of cereal there. You have to buy, like, the cereal company. You know, you can't buy just one jar of peanut butter. You have to buy a swimming pool version of peanut butter. So I was there on, like, Friday, and I thought, what are all these people doing here? The parking lot is packed. On Sunday, I did my weekly grocery shopping. I'm thinking, why is it so crowded in here? Why can't I push my cart down the aisle? I'm getting all cranky. And then I realized, oh my God, it's the Super Bowl. They're all here buying chips and beer and dip for their Super Bowl parties. This is like a national holiday in the US, and they're all going to do one thing. All these people are going to watch the Super Bowl. I would be willing to bet the 111.5 million figure, I would say that's probably underestimating the number of people that watched it in bars and Super Bowl parties.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they all pay attention to the commercials. They're all watching the commercials.
People talk about the commercials as much as the game now, as well as the halftime show. But before we get to the halftime show, which I think was where we found the real winner of the day, we had some commercials, and I think the movie ones were dreadful.
Ugh. You know what
Noah,
it is?
Noah with Russell Crowe was a disaster, I thought.
Yes.
Now, none of it matters. It just raises name recognition. And by the time the movie comes out, you can have new ads and let people know and do a more effective job. But you always want every ad to be good, of course. And this early ad was you had a shot of Noah's wife and family that looked like Abercrombie and Fitch models rather than people back three thousand years ago, you know, trying to survive. They look like they're ready to go to the beach.
Yeah, well, they all have great teeth, which I'm sure Noah did not.
Spider-Man 2, that was a disaster.
It was a music video. Basically,
it looked like a video game. I think if you're a real geek and you get off on finding what villains are involved, there were like two or three or four different elements of the comic books that were mentioned. And I guess those people would enjoy, oh, look, they're going to have this guy. They're going to have that plot twist. But for anybody else, it was really sort of incomprehensible mess.
Yeah. You know, all of these films, because they only have a 30 second spot, it costs $4 million.
Or a minute. They have some.
Yeah,
of them
they
are
could.
A minute.
Some
Spider-Man
2
was a minute at least.
No, it was a 30 second spot.
No, they had two spots.
Oh,
and
well,
they had a minute long trailer, basically. Done in 2 30-second spots.
Which cost them $8 million.
That's right. And now everybody knows it's coming out. And hopefully they can make a better trailer by the time the movie comes out. Transformers, Age of Extinction. That's the reboot of Transformers with Mark Wahlberg taking over for the plagiaristic Shia LaBeouf. And that was not a great trailer either. But compared to Spider-Man 2, it was like Shakespeare.
Man, you know, I did a piece on
Suck Me Shakespeare. Sorry about that, Bill.
Oh, brother. I did a piece on Celluloid Junkie on whether it was worth it for these studios to buy this ad. And I went.
Absolutely. You get so much free attention and people talking about it and playing the ads online.
And the price. If you want to reach 100 million people and your goal is reach, then you would pay for primetime advertisement, say during I don't know, The Voice or during American Idol or some big hit primetime TV show, you'd pay about $35 per 1,000 impressions. And so that's average. Guess what? Based on the number of viewers this year and based on the $4 million price, you paid about $35.87 for per CPM, so per 1,000 impressions. So it's about even.
Plus, every story about the ads lists all of them. They often link to them. They include the embed of the YouTube video. I was moving, so I spent the next day glancing at all the ads just to see what were the best ones. There was another movie ad. It was Need for Speed, a DreamWorks film starring Aaron Paul, who's one of the stars of Breaking Bad, one of the best shows of all time, really. And he needs to pick better movie roles, I think.
I agree. Yes.
Yeah. And Bob, you know, last year, the year before, Eminem did an ad for Detroit.
Well, and it's for Chrysler and General.
No, Eminem did an ad for Detroit.
Yes, I know. That's actually a Chrysler ad.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, but he did it for Detroit was his argument why he's suddenly doing an ad after all these years. And it sort of extolled his hometown and talked about it and how great it was. And it was a very effective, good ad because he's from Detroit and he's young and whatever. Somehow it worked, even though he's Eminem. And, you know, it sort of helped promote Detroit and, of course, Chrysler. This year it was Bob Dylan and I just wanted to cry.
And it was more like, you know, about America. America's cars.
You can't outsource ingenuity. You can't outsource the men and the women on the line. America. You know,
actually, that's a very good impersonation of that commercial. And I thought, this commercial was like a minute and a half long. This was like a mini movie. And I kept thinking, really? This is going to be Bob Dylan? Are you serious?
Do you need money? Do you need money, Bob?
In the 60s, you would have, like, shot the person who suggested this.
Well, those days are gone. I just wish it had been an effective commercial that used him or his image well. And it didn't. It was just weird. why he's suddenly sounding like he's a, you know, flag waving patriotic. Yeah. And not that he never didn't like the men and women on the line of Detroit. I'm sure he loves and respects them, but it just was not done in a way that connected him to the brand of Chrysler in Detroit.
Yeah, I was waiting for him to say, now if you'll excuse me, I've got to go call Michael Bay to star in his next movie.
I'd open my car door, but the vandals took the handles.
you know what really didn't work? What really didn't work was the Red Hot Chili Peppers during the halftime show.
That's right. Though Seinfeld was the biggest ad of all, I think.
Oh, yeah, I would say that's true. And it was for what? I mean, it was for like comedians and cars getting
fun.
It was for his podcast.
But it was just done for fun. He has a video podcast called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And this was nominally an ad for that, but it wasn't really, because it was Jerry and George, the characters from Seinfeld, sitting in a diner talking about the Super Bowl and how Jerry couldn't go to a party because he wanted to be nice and spend it with George, who wasn't welcome at the party. And it was just a little riff on Seinfeld. It had nothing really to do to promote his podcast, but they sort of tacked it on at the end as an excuse for why they just, it was just sort of, I think he did it for fun. That's how rich he is. He can decide just to do a Super Bowl ad for fun.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, it was not to promote his podcast, or they would have been in a car getting coffee and doing their shtick.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really about that. It was the characters from the show walking. They didn't even drive up in a car, didn't they? They walked there, didn't they?
I don't know, but they were.
Were they in a car at all?
Yes, they were in like an old, Pinto or something.
Oh, that's right. That's right. They were in a car. So I guess technically it is those fictional characters getting in a car to get coffee. But still, it felt more like he just did it as a goof.
Yeah, it did.
And like you said, the Red Hot Chili Peppers were in the halftime show. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know why either. And I don't know why we're talking about them, because really, it should have been Bruno Mars. The whole show should have been Bruno Mars, who was the headliner for the halftime Super Bowl show. And believe it or not, more people tuned in to the halftime show than tuned in for the game. 115.5 million viewers for the halftime show.
It was a peak, the most ever for the halftime show. The most watched event of all time, frankly.
On television. So was the Super Bowl.
Talking about programmed television, there are events like the landing on the moon or the O.J. Simpson trial where every channel is showing footage and watching it. That's different. When we're talking about something on one particular channel, this is, you know, we're talking about that sort of record.
You're talking about a telecast, a single programmed telecast.
And in recent years, for much of the Super Bowl in the last 20 years, it's always been a big established superstar. U2, the Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen. The recent record holders were Madonna, who had the record for the most watched halftime show. And before her, Beyonce, who has had a relatively long career with, you know, Destiny's Child and her solo career. Bruno Mars has just got his second album out. He's brand new. He's a kid compared to these people, but he's one of the best-selling artists of the last 5 years. Tons of singles that he's written for other people. But still, I think they thought they want Bruno Mars, and I think they panicked a little bit and said, hey, what if you let the Red Hot Chili Peppers pop in and do one of their songs?
Yeah, what if people don't know who Bruno Mars is?
Well, fair enough. I bet he was introduced to the world in a way that has not happened on the Super Bowl platform for a long, long time, if ever. This really, you know, could take him to, I think people know his songs, but as far as him and who he is and that he's the star and he sang all these songs, this clearly is by far the biggest platform he's ever had. It's a huge change. I mean, U2 was sort of, people were reminded again how great they were and what a sterling world-class act they are after following 9/11 with their moving Super Bowl tribute. And, you know, other artists have proved themselves, I guess, if that's a word. But Bruno Mars, I mean, when's the act at this level? I mean, maybe Black Eyed Peas. And I think they fell flat.
Ugh.
I don't think they were helped at all by the Super Bowl. But this was not a three-ring circus. This was not, you know, lots of different celebrities and stunts and jumping through hoops. It was just him and his band on stage playing their hearts out. You know, they're dancing in unison. They got a big horn section. It was very tight and sharp. Even when Red Hot Chili Peppers came in, he sang with them a little bit. They did more dancing behind them. And at the end, it's him alone in a spotlight, seems like the field is empty, and it's just him singing a ballad that he smartly let soldiers dedicate to their loved ones back home, soldiers overseas. So you got to wave the flag, you got the heart-thumping American patriotism, but then it's just him in a spotlight singing, and he's holding the attention of the whole stadium and 100 million people around the country just singing a ballad, which is kind of a ballsy way to end it, and I thought it was incredibly effective.
Yeah, and this was one of the few Super Bowls where they were playing in an open-air stadium. A lot of the Super Bowls lately, a lot of these games, because they, you know, it's a big televised event, they can't cancel it. So they put it in the Superdome, or they put it in a domed stadium, a covered stadium. Well, this one was not only outside, it was the first cold weather Super Bowl in, I think, ever. And they were able to light off fireworks, and boy, did they do a great job.
Yeah. Now, I did not watch the shows that followed the Super Bowl because I was traveling. New Girl followed the Super Bowl with Prince as a guest star, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. They both, of course, set record highs for their audiences. They did pretty much the best in years for a sitcom, and about equal when you add it all up to what Elementary did last year after the Super Bowl. Did you watch those shows, and were they effective creatively?
You know what? I watched on and off. I watched New Girl, so I can't speak.
I want to see Prince play ping pong. So I've got to watch that. Well, one ad that we didn't talk about was Beats Music. This is the streaming music service from Dr. Dre and
Jimmy Iovine.
Jimmy Iovine, thank you so much. They had a Super Bowl ad. I didn't think it was a very good ad at all, but it was an ad promoting their streaming music service called Beats Music, which just launched like a week and a half ago, 2 weeks, and it starred Ellen DeGeneres doing goofy dancing. It was a playoff on Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and clearly the point of the ad was to reach families and parents and mothers and people who are not into streaming music and barely know what it exists. They're like, look, you can get a family plan, $15 a month for like four people or something like that. It looked like a really good bargain, frankly. And that's clearly they want to reach a big general audience for Beats Music, and they used a Super Bowl ad to get their message out.
Yeah, well, and Ian Rogers, who used to run Top Spin Media, is also a part of Beats Music. Unfortunately, Top Spin Media had some layoffs last week.
And so is Time Inc., which just is about to lay off 500 people because they're going to go public, and nothing pleases investors more than getting rid of employees.
Yes, all that, cut all that fat.
Yeah, employees, blah, blah, blah. So Beats Music did launch, right, like a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago?
Well, yeah, it launched. I mean, kind of, because it launched.
Sort of like healthcare.gov launched?
Yeah, exactly. It just goes to show you, you know, you can scream about how people can't get their, you know, to the healthcare website for the United States. But guess what? You couldn't get to Beats Music either initially. So it's just when you have that much demand, it's hard. It's not easy.
Yeah, it's very hard. Yeah, and the initial launches, you're almost always going to have bugs. That's why my website's taking forever. But did you think the ad was any good?
You know, I
thought it was weird.
I thought it was weird, but I kind of went, okay. I didn't think it was bad. I didn't think it was great.
Yeah. Well, you know, Beats Music is, they've got, assume, a high-quality audio stream. I don't know where they have different versions for different prices. But Neil Young, of course, has his own
Pono format,
which is, what do we call it, an audio format?
Yeah.
A digital audio format. Yeah. He wants high quality, not even CD level, which is what we've degraded down from. He wants studio quality audio available to people on digital media. So if you're listening to something on your iPad or your computer, you're streaming music, he wants to be able to use Pono so you can get great sound, not mediocre sound like an MP3, not so-so sound like you get it on a CD, but like the best possible sound you can get. And he's apparently going to launch it at South by Southwest. And I think the one way he could really make this effective is if he wins over one of these streaming services, whether it's Beats Music or Spotify or iTunes or Amazon, if he can convince record labels to make their music available in this format and they convinces them to a format, and that would mean anybody who subscribes to their service would get this super audio sound that would blow away even their CDs. I think that would really be the killer app that would make Beats Music or one of these other services do a lot better and distinguish themselves from everyone else.
I don't think that's going to happen. And at least it's not going to happen anytime soon. And that's because a lot of these services are geared towards mobile devices. And but you have, you know, not only are you going to have storage issues, you're also going to have streaming
issues. We don't know what the storage issue is yet, do we? And if they're streaming, they don't have storage issues because you're not storing it on your phone.
Yes, but you are using data, your data minutes or cap.
But we don't know what it's going to be.
Right.
Right? We don't know how it's going to stream down or the tech element to it. I assume they have a device and it's probably got some massive hard drive in it because how else can you do it?
Well,
it's got a big
think
file.
That, frankly, what's going to wind up happening is Neil Young is going to come over to my house and play me
the music.
That's right.
Well, yes, but think about it. You just said they have a lot of these services, right? They're all competing for the same people. And if you could offer exponentially better sound, and a lot of people now are streaming their music at home.
Yes.
You know, so if you're not having to download the actual digital file, yes, they're going to use up bandwidth, but hopefully they won't care about the bandwidth. They just want to play great music. And if you can play it side by side and it blows you away the way CD blew away cassettes and LPs, unless you're Neil Young, if you can do that, that really sets you apart. I think if the labels are remastering the music and making it available in Pono, I'm not going to buy my whole damn library again. There's no way. I got 10,000 albums. I'm not going to buy them again just to get better sound quality, but I would absolutely buy any service that would let me hear my albums that I have now upgraded to that new quality level. Because that's what Amazon and iTunes do sometimes. Like iTunes has higher quality level. And if you have a track on your library and they put it up in the cloud and they let you use their streaming service, if they have a better quality version, you upgrade automatically.
I know.
And now you have that better version. If they do that with Pono, I think that's the way he could do an end run around having to make everybody buy their music all over again. People aren't going to buy music ever again, right? They're not going to have libraries. They're just going to subscribe. And so if he can get one of these services to adopt it and enough labels to offer it, people will have access to great sounding music.
Are you trying to say that if he is able to do that, it would be a big deal?
Absolutely. It'd be a very big deal.
Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story... this is totally overhyped nonsense. Hilary Mantel's historical novels reimagining Thomas Cromwell as a sympathetic figure proved unlikely bestsellers in the last few years. Now they're conquering other media as well. The Royal Shakespeare Company just mounted a massive six-hour adaptation of the books, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. Those are two different titles, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. And they mounted those to major acclaim at Stratford-upon-Avon. You may recognize that name. Billy Shakespeare did a few plays
there.
Suck
me, Shakespeare.
Yeah. They're sure to come to the West End and eventually...
I hope my mom's not listening to this podcast.
Oh, brother. Well, all these things, they're going to head to Broadway, not to mention get expanded when Mantle finishes the final volume in the trilogy, because nobody writes just one book anymore. If Hemingway were alive, he would have written The Old Man and the Sea 2. I'm sure of it. On TV, the BBC is sparing no expense for a six-hour miniseries of the first book. They waited 1 year for stage actor Mark Rylance to be free of all commitments so he could play the central role of Cromwell. Now Damian Lewis of Homeland has been approached about tackling the mercurial divorce-crazy King Henry VIII. Peter Strohan?
Strown? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, well, he got an Oscar nomination for his contribution to the screenplay of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, so I should know how to pronounce it. He wrote the screenplay. It will air in 2015. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Very big deal. You need to read the books. You need to read the books, for God's sakes. It's a huge hit theatrical production. It's going to come to the West End. It's going to win all the Oliviers. It's going to come to Broadway and do great there. I love the casting of the miniseries. I haven't been this excited for a project in ages, but the fact that they waited a year for Mark Rylance, who is no big star, I mean, he's a beloved theater person, but he's certainly not a draw in film or television by any stretch of the imagination. But my God, he was born to play this role of the smartest man in the room, maneuvering everybody around him. It's going to be just terrifically good.
I'm waiting for the audiobook version.
It's out there.
Well, then I want Neil Young to come over and read it to me in Pono, in the Pono format. Now, the news gets worse and worse for Jeff Zucker over at CNN. You might recall Jeff Zucker, he of NBC fame or in fame.
The Today Show.
Yeah. Well, the beleaguered 24-hour news channel had its third lowest viewership in history in January. That's a bad thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But hey, they're not the only ones feeling the pressure. CNBC managed to score the hottest new programming in the news genre with a show airing two nights a week that beat everything on CNN and everything on MSNBC, except for the Rachel Maddow show, In the Key Demos. And we know how important those key demos are. Only Fox's primetime lineup beat back this news competitor. And what was it? What was it that that beat it back? Reruns of ABC's reality show Shark Tank. That's what was showing on CNBC. Why even bother covering the news then? Big deal or big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, it's just talk. News talk is in the... What is it called? It's in the bucket. It's in the ditch. It's doing terrible. I don't know how to say it. But I mean, the idea that a rerun of Shark Tank, a reality show I've never even watched, is winning the time slot and beating almost everybody except Fox, that's so depressing. I mean, that's just, I'm sure there's a lot of channels that are beating the, those news channels in the ratings. And that's just indicative of it, that, that people would watch a rerun of Shark Tank before the news. They've got to get stronger programming all around. They can't wait for big events anymore. They know that Fox has redefined what can be happening in a news channel, that you don't just wait for big events. You got to have personalities. You got to have strong programming 24 hours a day. And Jeff Zucker's trying to turn that ship around, but it feels more like the Titanic every day.
Well, you know what Fox News says? You give me the prose poems, we'll give you the war. Little Citizen Kane reference for you. And of course, that's a reference to William Randolph Hearst, but that's another story entirely.
Yes.
Now that the Directors Guild of America has renewed its labor contracts with the studios, the Writers Guild is wading into the fray. Normally, they wait until much closer to the deadline, but this time they're starting off talks 3 months in advance. That's actually waiting right up into the last minute, in my opinion.
Not for them.
Yeah. Don't expect that to mean talks will go smoothly. No, never. The WGA is required in its bylaws to give members a heads up on what they'll be tackling. And this time, they've said despite record profits at many studios, the honchos are calling for a $60 million cutback. That's right, $60 million in cutbacks. And this is a quote. These proposed rollbacks for writers come at a time of unprecedented prosperity for the studios. That's what their, I guess that's a quote from their statement. They go on to say, the collective profits of our six major bargaining partners, Disney, CBS, Comcast, Fox, Time Warner, and Viacom, just hit a record $40 billion. This prosperity is based on our work. We are the creative force driving it. Are $60 million in rollbacks a just reward? And that's the end of the quote. The major goal for the WGA is raising pay, of course, for writers working on basic cable so it can reach parity with major networks. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's good that they're starting relatively early as far as they're concerned. But how depressing is it that, of course, the studios start with, hey, you know, we don't want to come with a good agreement and a good offer on cable so we can start off on good note. No, we want to cut back even further.
You know, this is a true negotiating ploy, in my opinion. They basically say, your pension, your welfare, your health, listen, $60 million in cuts there. Now, all of a sudden, you're arguing about $60 million in cuts to pension, health, and welfare rather than negotiating for better deals on streaming media, better deals on new media, and better deals on cable. So when the studio has actually come back and say, okay, fine, we'll keep the, we won't cut back on pension, health, and welfare. You know what you're not talking about? All the things you should be.
Well, yes, that's the way to start a rancorous negotiation and perhaps have a shutout. But if you want to look at what you're making profits on and be reasonable and recognize that inflation rises and people need more things and basic cable can't pretend it's the poor second cousin to primetime anymore, then you deal with reality and make reasonable offers based on what's going on, not on your fantasy of just attack, attack, attack. Work with them together and everybody can make money. There's no reason to be rancorous. And yet they're firing people left and right, no matter how much money they make. So the WGA has a right to be scared.
Fire them all, that's what I say. Well, you know, if Shia LaBeouf is listening to this podcast, and we know he is, he'll want to pay attention to our next story, the playwright of a work that riffs off Three's Company, and by not rip, I mean riff off Three's Company. It's taking them to court to gain the rights to mount his own work, called 3-C, or 3C, after the apartment number from the hit sitcom, the satire by David Ajmi, I guess that's how you pronounce his name. It uses elements of the show, but it says in a new way. Instead of a light farce about a straight man pretending to be gay so he can room with two girls under the disapproving eye of their landlord, 3C is about a closeted gay man pretending to be an out gay man for the same reason. I don't even know if what I read makes any sense.
It does.
According to the New York Times, the satire delves into the character's self-loathing and includes drug use, foul language, and other dark themes, i.e. what every Sundance movie had in it. No one would confuse it with a stage production of the show itself, of course, which is more Boeing than Last Exit to Brooklyn. Ajmi says others want to mount the play and a publisher wants to put it into print. But the rights holders of the TV show are quashing his fair use exploration of this iconic show. They say they are actively looking to exploit the series via the stage, and this would interfere, because I definitely think that a Three's Company musical is on the way. What would Shia do in this situation, Michael? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but there's always the question of what's fair use, how much, you know, it's hard. There's no fast rule. You have to look at each property individually, which is what makes it so hard. You know, you can't have a judge rule on every show in advance. So you're going to have these court battles, because he says, hey, I'm totally, you know, changing this show up to explore new things. And they're saying, no, you're not. You're just ripping off our idea. So it's hard to say. But, you know, I believe them when they say they're trying to turn it into a stage show, because you've had, you know, I Love Lucy and the Brady Bunch and a lot of other classic sitcoms get turned into stage productions. And in the UK, you've got Back to the Future. There's a big musical version of that movie being turned into a West End musical. Time to the 30th anniversary of the film. It's going to be there, I guess, in the fall of, is it 1985? So I guess it's 2015.
That's right. And that's exactly when Marty McFly in Back to the Future 2, October 2015, that's when he sped ahead October 2015. And so this is what I have to say about this, because Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, the writers, and Robert Zemeckis, the director of this film, yes, they said that they've been working on this idea for a Back to the Future musical for a decade, and that they're going to include music from Alan Silvestri. They're going to write the book.
New songs, and also use songs from the movie, like Gotta Be Good.
Here's what I think they should be working on, okay? Because 2015 is a year away. Here's what I want. I want my self-tying shoelaces. I want my hoverboard. And and where's my flying DeLorean? They have 1 year to work it out.
Well, they're not the only one reaching back into the past, are they?
No, actually, Walt Disney Studios is reaching back into the past. See what I did there? They're reaching back into the past, like Back to the Future.
So, gonna go back in time.
Huey Lewis in the news. Not just Huey Lewis. The news joined him. Well, Walt Disney Studios is going to resurrect two of its well-known character creations, Chip and Dale. And it's not Chip and Dale, you know, with an ampersand or with an A-N-D.
They're not a team, and they're not a team. They're just an They're sort of friends with benefit. No, I don't know what they are, but they're friends.
Chip apostrophe N Dale.
Keep it clean.
They are the two animated chipmunks who first appeared in a 1943 short, and they will be the stars of a live-action feature to be helmed by award-winning commercial director Robert Rugen.
And I bet he's done a Super Bowl ad.
I bet you're right, and this just screams run in the other direction. Apparently, the film is going to tell an origin story, quote-unquote, whatever that means for chipmunks, though this would be their first appearance in a live-action film. And when asked to comment on the news, Chip and Dale's longtime arch-rival, platinum recording artist Alvin of Alvin and the Chipmunks, stated, and this is a quote, "So what? We've already made that movie, like, four times. Is Chip and Dale's return to the big screen a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?"
Well, it's very much a big whoop. But before people complain that Hollywood has no new ideas, blah, 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 et cetera, you know what? I mean, people have done this throughout all of history. I mean, the stories of the gods, the stories of Hercules, the stories of Robin Hood, every epic mythic tale that you can think of gets told and retold and added onto again and again and again. Tarzan, Spider-Man, Superman. I know it's exhausting when it's a $200 million movie, but it's nothing new. People have always told and retold the same stories around a campfire. So don't act like this is some crazy new phenomenon. People like it, and it's been done for thousands of years. You know, blame Homer.
I've been meaning to tell you this story I heard about a shepherd who... In any case, let's move on to ABC's Dancing with the Stars. It's the network's biggest reality hit, and they have just slimmed down. And that doesn't mean they've turned into The Biggest Loser, which is NBC's biggest reality hit. Or no, actually, The Voice is their biggest reality hit. But The Biggest Loser is a reality hit on NBC. Are you following me here?
No.
Okay. Well, Dancing with the Stars has slimmed down not by reducing the number of has-been celebrities looking to foxtrot, but by getting rid of the live big band that performs during the dance routines. Yes, ABC is switching to backing tracks and a far more modest electric band, i.e. a Casio keyboard. ABC says with lots of modern music, it's really hard to try and capture that sound live. So why not just use the recording? The Musicians Union says they're just trying to save money by firing the 28-piece group, which has been performing on the show for 9 years. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, and it's a very depressing one. You know, this is their biggest hit reality show. It's one of their biggest hits, and maybe their biggest show, period. I mean, is there a bigger hit for ABC than Dancing with the Stars? It's a top 10 hit. I think it's their number one show. And of course, a show gets older and older. It costs more and more money to make. though that should be a little different for this show. They've got the judges, and that's it, and their hosts, but that's really it. And they're not demanding idol-type salaries, as far as I know. So why are you getting rid of the big band, the spontaneous live big band playing music? You're telling me that people would rather hear a backing track? It makes a big difference. When you go to a Broadway show, you want to have a full orchestra there. When you go see Dancing with the Stars, you want that big band there creating the music live. It creates a sense of excitement, not just for the audience, but for the people performing. So I think it's a tragic mistake as far as trying to save pennies by really cutting the legs out from under a show.
Get it? Get it? Because it's about dancing. That was much funnier than my Aesop's Fable joke. Well, that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. And I guess maybe we should talk about, since we were just talking about music, let's talk about more music.
Let's do it.
Okay, well, I don't know really what to say here, but do you remember the Oscar-nominated song that we talked about? I guess it was last week or the week before, the obscure number for a faith-based film that no one had ever heard of, the song or the film. We explained that it made the cut thanks to the connections of one of the writers of the song. That was Bruce Broughton, an Emmy-winning and Oscar-nominated composer and former board member of the Academy itself. Well, that's also why it got cut. Yes, Alone Yet Not Alone, which is the name of the song, was removed from the list of nominees because it was determined Broughton unfairly campaigned for the song. His sin? Emailing dozens of the 239 members of the music branch to let them know his song was eligible and where it could be found among the nearly 70 tunes sent for consideration to voters. They send out a CD and a DVD, and it's just one track after another. If the same steps had been taken by a publicist, it would not have raised any eyebrows. Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael. Actually,
well,
never mind.
No, we're in Inside Baseball.
We're on Inside Baseball.
Is it a strike or a ball? Well, there's a lot to say here. First of all, I had no idea that they tried to keep the music nominees anonymous.
Yes.
Basically, they sent out these songs and you're not supposed to know who wrote them. You're supposed to just, with the Solomon-like decision, decide what's your favorite song out of the 70 or 80 that they send you.
Because let's face it, we've all listened to 80 songs over the past month.
Yeah. Is there any other category where they try to hide the people being nominated?
I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, I meant to ask people who I know who get an Oscar ballot, but I mean, you'd have to speak to someone in the music branch, and I don't know anybody in the music branch. But as far as I know, I mean, certainly the acting and directing and writing, they don't say, oh, you're just doing it for her and try to keep it a secret who the writer is. So why they have this anonymous thing? I think they say, well, if you know who it is, you'll just look for the big names and listen to those songs first. Well, okay. I'm going to go to the Martin Scorsese film first before the movie by someone I've never heard of. I'm sorry. But they have this weird tradition in the music to keep it anonymous about who wrote the song. And of course, people know the big ones. They know U2 wrote that song for the Mandela film. They know this, that, and the other thing. But they don't know all 70, of course. So they have these songs. And they just listen to them and have no idea who wrote what. And they have no guidance. And they're supposed to be kept anonymous. And when he sent out that email, he was letting them know, I wrote this song, track number 54 or whatever it was.
I think it was track 57. And he actually said which track it was.
Of course, because he's saying you got 70 songs. Listen to mine. But the big problem was not even that he identified himself, but the fact that he used the email list, as far as they're concerned, he used the email list he got access to as a governor to send out the email. Right. So now there are publicists who independently gather email contacts for people in different branches, and that's okay. But they felt he used the actual Academy email list in order to promote himself and to send out the email identifying his track. And that use of their email database is where they felt he went over the line.
Well, look, when this was first announced on January 16th that Alone Yet Not Alone was nominated for Best Song, and everybody
said, what the heck?
Yeah, everybody said that. And
it may be the lowest grossing film to ever get a major nomination in history.
And
I mean, it grossed
$134,000.
Yeah, my God. It literally did not exist. That's low for a faith-based film.
Yes. I mean, faith-based films, they often make $10, $20 million.
Well, not 20. That's a lot. But yeah, they can make into the seven figures, even though they're released independently, four-walled around the country. And they're still breaking into the top 10 sometimes in an opening weekend and stuff like $100,000. You know, that's nothing. And people are like, we've never heard of this film or this song. But here's the problem. It's a faith-based film. The song is sung in the movie. A paraplegic female evangelist. Oh, my God. You know, like her husband has to press on her stomach to help her diaphragm move so she can breathe and sing the song. And so now you've giving them a nomination and then taking it away, and you look like the cruelest person alive.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, it. But at the same time, you could see why the Academy would be fearful that it does really look like there's some impropriety here.
Well, it's not impropriety. He broke the rules. They said you can't use our database to, you know, you're a governor. You're not supposed to use the database for outside purposes. If people market it, it should be a publicist doing it, and they should get the information on their own. He didn't do that. He marketed it himself, and he used their database, according to them, to reach out to people. But of course, he says they hate religious movies. Another Academy Award winning producer says the Hollywood hates religion. The Hollywood hates God. That's Gerald Molin, who won an Oscar for one of the producers of Schindler's List.
Yeah.
And he's a conservative, you know, figure in Hollywood. One of the rare people who's outspoken. Good for him. But he's claiming they did it just because it's a religious film, as opposed to the common sense thing, which is nobody'd heard of this film and nobody could figure out how and why it got nominated. But it points to a bigger problem, that this category is a big mess. Not just this year, but they've been out of touch for a long time. And every year they seem to move to a new category. Oh, we got to fix foreign films. We got to fix documentaries. Well, now they need to fix the best song category, because they've been wildly out of touch with what the most popular song and the best songs for the movies. And it's an insider's club where they're not pinpointing quality, and they're not even pinpointing quality or popularity. They're just missing the boat on every level.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. I think, what, a couple years ago, there were only two songs nominated, when there could have been at least four or five.
It's horrible. Yeah, that was terrible. And of course, the weird thing is that, you know, best songs get no credit or attention. I love music used in films, not just original music, but other songs that are used in a movie, source music, songs that already exist. I always want to see that list of song credits at the end of a movie. And if you go online to IMDb or Wikipedia or all these other databases, you can see everything. Who the makeup did, who was casting, who did cinematography. You can see everything except for the music credits. That is the one thing that nobody includes online in any comprehensive fashion, or at least I've never seen it. It's certainly not on IMDb. So if you see a movie and you hear a great song and you don't have access to the DVD and you want to know what it was, you can't look it up online. And so these things desperately need attention, and they should be celebrating the songwriters. Why keep it a secret? We know who wrote the screenplay. It shouldn't be this bizarro blind test like it's The Voice and we got to swivel our chair. So songs need more attention. The music credits need more attention. They're not anywhere to be found. So it's always a mystery what songs were used in the movie and how and who wrote them. And they're out of touch with what the best songs are, whether popular and or critically good. And there's one more puzzle here. When they took out this song, why didn't they replace it with another song?
Yeah, that's very awkward. I guess it's because it's in the rules that they don't do that. I don't know. But
they used to do it.
Yes.
They used to replace, if something got cut, they would replace it with the runner-up, the next song. But apparently, I guess they changed the rules at some point in the 80s or 90s. I don't know why. Because if for some reason you have to eliminate something, why not bring it? That's the whole point, is to bring attention. So they lost another opportunity there. So it's just a messed up deal from beginning to end. They need to reform the rules process. They need to stop hiding who wrote the songs. They need to stop Bruce Broughton from using their email list.
I mean, he was very honest about it and said, yeah, and he didn't email.
He wasn't honest. He said, why would anybody think twice about it? Everyone does it. Like, well, no, everyone doesn't get access to the Board of Governors email list and then use it to promote themselves. Because as far as we know, it's never happened before in history.
Yeah. Now, before we get to our listener email, we did have a story on net neutrality. Do we really want to go into it? I mean,
we were very worried about it. Democrats in Congress are trying to step forward and keep the current rules in place until they can pass a new law and say, yes, the FCC has the right to oversee this until we can pass something that will legislatively pass muster with the courts. But their chances of getting it passed are dim. You know, getting out of the House especially will be very difficult. But at least they're trying, and there is some focus on net neutrality, because that really is a big issue that will affect a lot of us for many years to come.
Yes, and I will say that it is my congressman that is doing this, Henry Waxman of California, who not only put this bill forth, but in the same breath said, I'm also not going to run for re-election. He's been in Congress for like 40 years. So he did this, and then, you know, kind of quietly and not so quietly said, I'm not running again. So for 40 years, you've had me, and now I'm leaving. And by the way, you have 24 hours to nominate one person or two people or three people for the Democratic Party. Yeah, it was a big mess. But hey, we don't talk about politics on this show. We talk about entertainment. We do it every single week, and you can actually let us know what you want us to talk about. You can write to us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us, leave us a voicemail. 888-567-SAND is the phone number. That number again is +1-888-567-7263. We want to know what you're thinking. Let us know. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, which I think is now called the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, or any podcast aggregator. We give the show away for free. Rate and review the show in those marketplaces. It does help us out. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us. It's where you'll find those ways to contact us. It's where you'll find those ways to follow us. We have a Twitter account. It can be found at showbizsandbox, so twitter.com/showbizsandbox. And guess what? We have a Facebook page where Raul Buril posted the story about the Oscar or the Academy rescinding that Oscar nomination. You can post the story, too, if you want us to cover it. It's facebook.com/showbizsandbox, or just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and we should come right up. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is not by Bruce Broughton. It's by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Every single week, Michael Gilds has a brand new website. This week, it is...
Bruno Mars is short in stature, but tall in talent.com.
Or if you can't find Michael's writing on entertainment and other subjects there, try michaelgilts.com or run on over to the Huffington Post. I'm sure you'll find it there. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.